The next case this morning is number 041234, Interclaim Holdings Limited et al. Against Nesquatli, Loadholtz, Richardson & Poole. Mr. Cole, we'll wait till the courtroom clears and counsel has a chance to set up. I think we can begin, Mr. Cole. Thank you.
Judge Ripple, and may it please the court. The jury below returned a verdict of $8.3 million on what Interclaim called its misappropriation damage theory and returned a verdict of zero on what it called the Canadian bankruptcy theory. If I can borrow one of Judge Kaczynski's more interesting phrases, it seems to me as we'll show that the damage theory was a souffle, all air and no substance. For a number of years, this court has been at pains to warn both bench and bar that there must be proof of actual damages proximately caused by a defendant. The principle has been reaffirmed as recently as 6 weeks ago in the Haslam case, in which Judge Posner says, it doesn't matter whether the conduct that you prove was deliberate, and indeed the word he used was even reprehensible. You must prove actual damages. You can't do it speculatively, and you can't do it through inference and guesswork. And you have to do it without any kind of burden shifting at all. It seems to us, as we argued in the briefs, that there was absolutely no harm shown in the context of this case under the misappropriation theory. And let me explain to you why I think that's so. The harm that was identified by Interclaim and by the district court is this. When the temporary restraining order was lifted on the alienation of assets by Cindy Down, the potential for those assets to be levied upon in Canada, as it was envisioned by Interclaim's plan, vanished. That was the harm, and that was the only harm ever identified by anybody. That harm was not harm at all. It was dependent upon and contingent upon events that were still in the womb of time. For example, if Down won the underlying action in Madison County, there would be no basis to levy in Canada, and thus the lifting of the TRO would be absolutely inconsequential analytically. If Down lost, but lost small, there was more than ample funds, up to $32 million under the settlement agreements, in place to cover whatever potential Interclaim had. In short, Down had to lose, and had to lose big, in order for there to be any harm at all from the lifting of the temporary restraining order. And the courts have made absolutely clear that a damage model that is based upon inference and guesswork and fancy is not a damage model that will sustain an award. The second flaw, in terms of concluding that there was actual damage under the misappropriation theory, is that it placed Interclaim in a far better position than it would have been in had there been no breach. Had there been no breach of contract and no breach of fiduciary duty, and had the case gone to its ultimate conclusion, Interclaim's recovery was a function in part, of course, of the amount of the award in the underlying action, as its own expert said, and more importantly, it was a function solely and exclusively of the International Claims Enforcement Agreement, which was in place. That agreement placed a $2 million cap on direct costs. Direct costs included attorney's fees. Now, not only did the agreement say that, but more importantly, the evidence that Interclaim introduced at the trial proved it conclusively, and here is the evidence. paragraph, I believe it's 13 of the amended complaint expressly said, it's a judicial admission, direct costs are capped at $2 million. Interclaim's own manager testified, pursuant to its own direct examination, the damages were capped at $2 million. The retention agreement between Interclaim and Ness Motley represented that the cap was $2 million on direct costs, unless, of course, there had been what was called judicial sanction to get more. Well, there was never judicial sanction. The International Claims Enforcement Agreement excluded salaries and had no provision for profit. These things are not debatable. These are not things the jury could have speculated on. This was Interclaim's own proof. And so what does it come out to be? It comes down to this, that a minimum of $6.3 million was awarded to Interclaim under its sort of damages in the air approach. $6.3 million more than it could have recovered in Canada under the ICEA had there been no breach of contract. That is a windfall that, as a matter of law, cannot stand. It is a windfall that the courts have said time and again affects the integrity of the judicial process and will not be allowed to stand.
This is a valuation problem, though, isn't it?
It isn't a valuation.
How to value confidential information that has been misappropriated. That's the problem.
No, it's not a valuation problem at all.
Let me finish the question. And if that is the problem, why isn't cost one indicator of value? I mean, for valuation generally, that seems to be the case. That apparently was a theory applied here, wasn't it?
No, the theory applied here, if you look at it, was simply this. We can't collect anymore because the assets are gone, and the value is what we expended. That is a delusive misappropriation model for two reasons.
Well, now, it may be delusive in this case, and you're certainly free to argue that, but cost is one way of getting at value, isn't it?
Only if there is a relationship between the acquisition cost and the value. There is no harm, Your Honor, in this case, which is a threshold issue before you ever get to the value. What is the harm? The only harm that there can be is if Down loses in the underlying action and loses in a very large amount. If Down wins, the lifting of the TRO, which is what Interclaim said caused the loss of value, which is then valued at its cost of acquisition, there's no harm. It doesn't make one bit of difference. But
the valuation has to be made at a particular point in time, and you're saying that the subsequent events may affect that.
Well, I'm saying
that the amount should have been discounted for the possibility of subsequent events.
It's not a question of subsequent events. It's a question of whether or not, at the moment you attempt to value something, you have been harmed. You cannot tell whether there has been harm of 1 cent or $8.3 million. But the second, until you know what happens in the underlying action, the second aspect in terms of your question, Your Honor, about valuation is simply this. Before you can determine value, you must know whether you could have gotten that or you couldn't. Now, $4 million approximately was spent in losing endeavors in Canada in legal fees. Interclaim's expert testified the only way those dollars could be recovered would be in an action in Canada that Interclaim must win, and that you must proceed either under, you must prove there was value conferred or there was unjust enrichment. $4 million in losing endeavors in Canada that the Canadian courts ultimately concluded constitute an abuse of process or an unreasonable search and seizure, by any measure do not include value. And if they do not include value, they could not possibly have won in Canada, even had there been no breach. So it really isn't a question of valuation at all. What they simply said was, we expended $8.3 million. We're entitled to it. We're entitled to it without regard to whether we win in the underlying action. And we are entitled to it even if we couldn't have won had there been no breach. That, Your Honor, is not a question of valuation.
Aren't those all contingencies? And perhaps the valuation ought to be discounted for the contingencies. I don't know. But I mean,
the valuation ought to be
there are subsequent contingencies.
The valuation ought to be discounted to zero because you
maybe
can't
so.
Value.
I don't know, but that's Nobody suggested that as far as I know.
Well, we've certainly said in the briefs that as a matter of law, you can't have harm in any amount given the contingencies. That's precisely what made the case speculative. It's precisely what made the case unripe for review. And it's precisely why the case, you could not, so long as these contingencies remained unresolved, that is precisely why there could be no harm. And the district court never explained what the harm was, and Interclaim has never explained what the harm was. And if one looks at this in an analytical and sequential way, it is impossible to say that there was harm, let alone that there was $8.3 million worth of harm.
The judge suggested a stay of that proceeding pending the resolution of the underlying proceeding.
No, she didn't. What she said, Your Honor, was at some point in time when they raised the Section 1115 argument, and she said, wow, that's a great argument. And she then said, well, why didn't you ask for a stay? And I think the lawyers, and it wasn't us, the lawyer said, Judge, are you serious? And she said, touche. The issue in terms of a stay, which is exactly what Interclaim has said, is that there's a waiver because of these contingencies because we didn't ask for a stay. The burden of proof, as Haslund and all of the cases teach, is a burden that must be sustained by the plaintiff, and it must be sustained, as Haslund says, without burden shifting. The lawyers representing Interclaim had made a determination, as they argued from the threshold of this case, that that Interclaim could not sustain its burden of proof so long as what you've called these unresolved contingencies remained. And that's absolutely right. Interclaim chose to go forward. It insisted on going forward. And the fact that that Ness Motley did not ask for a stay did not absolve Interclaim of maintaining its burden of proof. The judge had her own institutional responsibilities. She chose to let the case go forward for whatever reason. We asked that it go forward because we believe the burdens of proof could not be sustained, and indeed they cannot be. So there's not a...
At the time of this trial, though, all these other things were just a matter of probabilities, weren't they? Probable this is going to happen, or that might happen, or something else might happen?
Not at all. Your Honor, what you're really saying is, I think, that... Let me answer to you this way. These unresolved events are the kinds of things that make it impossible for cases to proceed as long as they are unresolved. That is what the doctrine of ripeness is about. That's what the doctrine of mootness is about. That's what the case or controversy requirement is about. Things that might occur in the future. So long as they might occur in the future, and you don't know what they are, yet they are certain to occur, there is no way to prove actual damage. What if down one? With the lifting of the...
Well, we've got to determine damage as of now. This is the trial now, not in the future.
That's precisely the difficulty in their deciding to go forward. You can't resolve it now. And to say, well, you have to resolve it in some way is really, I think, with all deference, to beg the question. The question is, can you resolve it? And the answer is, you cannot. If Down wins, the lifting of the TRO causes no harm. And until one knows that, what you have is an event that has done nothing at that moment in time. And so when you value at that moment in time this information at $8.3 million, all you have done is simply said, I expended that amount, that's what I value.
Well, as of now, according to the jury, there's been a misappropriation of certain information. That event has taken place.
Let me respond to that.
What information worth, I think, is the issue.
What is the information worth? It certainly isn't what you spent in losing endeavors in Canada to try to maintain a win. That isn't the value of information at all. That's simply a cost that you expended. It conferred no value and did nothing. The jury was instructed, Your Honor, that in order to find misappropriation of confidential information, they had to find misappropriation, and they had to find that the information was confidential. Neither occurred. There was no misappropriation of anything. The information was used exactly as it was intended to be used up until the time of about August or so of 2000. From that point on, it wasn't misappropriation. It's simply that the breach occurred and the information wasn't used to continue. More importantly, the information, all of it, every bit of it, was public and had been public for at least a year. It had been publicized in proceedings around the world. It related solely, Your Honor, to Down's assets, of which he knew. So if one looks at at it purely as a question of sufficiency, there was no evidence of misappropriation of confidential information. The information surely wasn't worth what had been expended. If you value it that way, you wind up with a windfall. Windfalls are, as a matter of law, prohibited. Damage models which rest on guesswork, and that's what this was, are prohibited.
You end up with a windfall. If you value it some other way, you end up with a loss. And all this does is protect you against loss. It's not a windfall.
Your Honor, if you could not have obtained $8.3 million in Canada in the event of an absence of breach, but you get it in the event of a breach, then you have a windfall, and the windfall is measured by the amount of money that is greater than you would have obtained had there been no breach. There is simply no way to argue the contrary. That's what a windfall is. The purpose of the law of damages is to put you in the position you would have been in and would have enjoyed had there not been a breach of contract or a breach of fiduciary duty. So let's assume there had been no breach of fiduciary duty. Would Interclaim have been able to recover $8.3 million, which is how they valued this information? The answer is no. And Interclaim has not ever responded as to how it could. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. We'll hear now from Mr. McCambridge.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, in response to the question of when the stay offer was made by Judge Pallmeyer, that was made before trial to both parties. Both parties declined that offer. At the instruction conference, when the defendant raised the Section 1115 argument for the very first time, Judge Pallmeyer did not ask about the stay. She said, why didn't you raise this before? I won't ask you why. When he did not respond, he said, you wouldn't ask. She said, touche. With respect to actual damage, in this instance, it was Interclaim that acquired and maintained judicial control over $100 million in Downs assets for nearly 20 months at great cost to Interclaim. Ness Motley's position is that Interclaim's information and the TRO had no value, and their destruction was therefore of no consequence to Interclaim. But the evidence is entirely to the contrary on the issue of injury. Ness Motley went to the court in Madison County and said, we need a TRO because if we don't have one, there will be irreparable injury. These assets will be gone, and it will be impossible to reassemble them. When Ness Motley made this deal with Down, that is precisely what happened. Within a short period of time, this is PX224A, within a short period of time, the assets were sold right out from under. Everything that Cindy had in her name was released. Now, the value, where did the value go? It is not true that there was no value. First, we have irreparable injury. Second, we have the situation in which 100% of the value, there was $60 million in net assets, $100 million in total, all of those assets, all of the value associated with those were carved up between two people, Ness Motley and Blair Down the criminal. The people who created those values, the people Interclaim that went forward and acquired judicial control over those assets, and the victims themselves were cut out, carved out by their own lawyers, Ness Motley, so that Ness Motley could acquire value for itself.
So that kind of goes to the punitive damage issue. Mr. Cole didn't really spend much time talking about that. But when Ness Motley went its separate way,
yes,
they solicited some ethical opinions. It's your view, I take it, that they didn't make a full disclosure of the situation when they got those opinions. So, I don't know if you're following me.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
What was really material that, in your view, that was not disclosed, and why would that have made a difference?
Well, there were misrepresentations made. Number one, there was a misrepresentation that the retainer agreement between Interclaim and Ness Motley provided that in the event of a conflict, that Ness Motley would be free to go its own way and terminate Interclaim as a client. That was untrue. In addition, there was a representation made that the...
And that was a statement that the people who gave the ethical opinion to Ness Motley relied on.
Those are... It's in the letters, yes, Your Honor. In terms of the consultants that were contacted, mm-hmm. was that representation made to them? Is that the question?
Yeah, and did,
yes.
did they rely on that in offering
yes.
an opinion that there
in
was
fact,
an ethical breach here by Ness Motley in doing what it did?
In fact, in Mr. Cummins' letter to them, it specifically assumed that to be true. That was a false assumption. It was based on information that had been given to him by the Ness Motley firm. In addition, they made the representation that the purpose of their termination of Interclaim as a client was to protect the interests of the class. That was a representation made to both of the expert consultants and actually throughout the trial to the jury. And
what did the class end up getting here?
Nothing.
I mean, a lot of these class action cases, the lawyers get big fees and the people in the class get a check for a buck or something like that. What happened here?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the class got nothing. The client, and I think one of the reasons that this is here with the court having an opportunity to actually look at what went on in this particular case, is that unlike the usual case where a Ness Motley plaintiff's class action mass tort firm doesn't really have a client, here they did. And I think that one of the very important portions let me just go to the punitive right now, Your Honor. What I'd like to talk about a little bit is reprehensibility. I think that the Supreme Court's been quite clear that that is a vital element for this court or any court reviewing a punitive damage award to consider. And in State Farm, there are five reprehensibility factors that are identified. And the court says an award is suspect if all of these factors are absent. In this case, at least three of the five were proven in spades. And there is an overlay that I think is critical, and that is that in each of these elements, Ness Motley and Down essentially hijacked the class action system, the court system, the vehicle that they were using to accomplish all of these depredations was the court. The TRO was issued by Ness Motley going to the court saying, we need this in order to prevent irreparable injury. Within 2 weeks of acquiring the TRO, based upon the representation of irreparable injury, they turned around and began the process of selling it. And in the process of selling it, they understood that Down was insistent that neither Interclaim nor the 29 directly associated with Interclaim received a penny. He understood that Down was motivated by animus and hatred, and he also understood that it was vital to them to make sure that they did everything possible to put Interclaim out of business, and they succeeded in doing that with the help of Ness Motley. One factor, did the targets of the conduct have financial vulnerability? Absolutely yes. Ness Motley knew it. Ness Motley knew that Interclaim had spent millions of dollars and committed a large part of its employee resources to this fight against Down. They knew that Interclaim needed the U.S. firm that would take this case on contingency and fund it. Ness Motley estimated it would cost them $4 million to do this case properly. They knew the funds were low. They knew from the very first meeting They came back and said to Mr. Kenny and the other interclaim people, boy, those guys, the down people, hate you. They're psychopaths. Why? Because they're attacking Down's stolen assets. They knew Down was trying to starve interclaim of funds. They knew that Down was attempting to drive them into bankruptcy. They participated in every anti-interclaim activity that Down requested. They had this information before they met with much of this information, before they released Cindy Down in September of 2000, and they had all of it by the time that they secretly released Blair Down in June of 2001. In addition, on financial vulnerability, we have the 29 victims who gave powers of attorney to interclaim and who were represented expressly by Ness Motley. Ness Motley knew these people as a group were old, sick, poor, and had been defrauded by Blair Down. They knew that before they began to talk to Down. Down insisted that none of the 29 could receive a penny in settlement because they had been associated with Interclaim, and Ness Motley agreed. They could have nothing. Then you have the balance of the victims. Were they financially vulnerable? Did Ness Motley know it? Absolutely. The record is full of that evidence. They too, as a group, were old, sick, poor, defrauded. They were targeted by Down because they were vulnerable. That's the evidence that Ness Motley presented to the court in Madison County. So that factor is fully satisfied. Did the
it's
conduct...
It's interesting to me how Madison County happens to be selected as the site for a
selected by
class action, yes, litigation.
That was a selection by Ness Motley.
Sure.
Next, we come to another factor. Did the conduct involve repeated actions? Absolutely. The illicit activities that were undertaken by Ness Motley and Down together against Interclaim, the 29, and the class ran over a period of about a year. It started in mid-August when they had their meeting here in Chicago. It ran through the formal termination of Interclaim in mid-September after they had been engaged in these negotiations for that entire month. It went on through the release of Cindy. It included their opposition to the efforts of their client to get some recompense, to participate, to intervene, to be a part of the settlement. It went on through multiple false court filings, misrepresentations where they used the offices of the court in Madison County to send out notices to class members, threatening them with things that they admitted at trial were not even serious, such as, is a legitimate defense that Down is going to raise that you participated in an illegal criminal activity, and they included the penalty for what Down is alleging that you did is time in jail and financial penalties. All of this was part of their scheme to hold down the total amount of claims, hold down the amount because their fee was dependent on it. If there were too many claims made, Down could blow up the settlement.
Well, the court in Canada actually found that a lot of these victims weren't really victims either.
Well, they identified a few, but in the materials filed here with the investigation in the U.S. and the balance of the materials in Canada, the vast majority, and that is why I said as a group.
I'd like to return to the question of, you know, what were the actual damages suffered as a result of this? Mr. Cole made the point about the direct cost being limited to $2 million. What's your response to that?
Yeah, that is not accurate. It's not accurate on two levels. First of all, the ICEA is an agreement that would govern if the case had gone all the way to its conclusion in Canada. And what the ICA actually provided is there was a cap of $2 million on the investment required by Interclaim, and that the actual recovery available to Interclaim was both its costs of enforcement, which in this instance were in the neighborhood of $5.5 million at the time, and half of the recovered proceeds. the confidential information model did not assume that this would run all the way to judgment. This was another damages model for quantification purposes. And in that, what we looked at was, at the time of the breach, when Ness, Miley, and Down together took control of all the work, took control of the asset, and divvied it up between themselves, was Interclaim injured at that point? Yes, that's fact of injury. In terms, because they had taken all of the value for themselves. The record shows that at an earlier point in the case, in the dispute with Down, that Down's people had gone and tried to buy off Interclaim itself for the same kind of thing, offering them several million dollars so long as they cut out the class. Interclaim said no. The notion that we don't suffer any damage at all because they commit a breach and they take all of the value, which to them was well in excess of $6 million, is wrong. So I think we've established injury. Once you've established injury, then we move to Haslund and Bendix. And especially where the jury has substantial latitude in quantifying damages, and also where the wrongdoer has impeded the quantification, that there's even additional latitude to be given. When we went to the jury, we said, we're offering to you what we spent in this battle against Down, and the value of that is reasonable because look at the asset that was frozen, $100 million, $60 million net that we had. At that point, Ness Motley said to the jury, on the confidential information model, their proposal was you should award the costs that were incurred by Interclaim from the point that they hired Ness Motley. So they were accepting, that was their proposal, but what they were doing was drawing a line in time. We both presented those models to the jury. We said look at full cost. They said cut it off at a point in time. The jury concluded that the most reasonable method of quantifying damages in this instance was to adopt the $8.3 million that they awarded to us.
Did some expert testify to the cost being one method of valuation or
there was
factor
not a,
in valuation?
There was not an expert, but Your Honor, we cited the Jensen case, an Illinois case that recognizes that, and there was, I believe, no expert testimony in that case either. What did Ness Motley argue? Did they raise this ICEA argument to the jury? They did not. They did not argue to the jury that the ICEA had anything at all to do with the model under which the jury actually awarded damages. So I think it's a complete diversion for them to be attempting to focus you on the ICEA. Had we gone the ICEA route, the damages were in the neighborhood of $27.7 million, not $2 million. I would finish on punitives unless the court has a question on something else. I talked about repeated actions. Finally, the third element under State Farm that is present in spades in this case is intentional malice, trickery, or deceit. The question posed by the Supreme Court was an either or. Was there intentional malice, trickery, or deceit, or was this a mere accident? Well, we know the evidence is overwhelming. This was no mere accident. We know that it proceeded over the 10-month period that I've already identified. Judge Pallmeyer concluded Ness Motley engaged in a course of conduct designed to benefit the firm and Down while harming the very clients Ness Motley was hired to represent. Both we included in our brief in substantial detail. There's substantial detail on it in Judge Pallmeyer's opinion. Within a day of the meeting with Down, recall that Ness Motley decided to ask Down to indemnify Ness Motley against claims by its client Interclaim, and to get Ness Motley, to get Down to pay for these so-called ethics opinions. In addition, early on, Ness Motley's co-counsel and kind of finder in this case, David Hoynes, he described the danger to Interclaim of a friendly lawsuit. Why should they use Ness Motley? And he warned them. He said there could be a friendly lawsuit here. Down could hook up with a friendly law firm to settle the case in exchange for a fat fee, cut out Interclaim, and construct a claims procedure to cut the victim's recovery to nothing. Now that's the co-counsel they had in this case, and what happened? That is exactly what happened, but it turned out that the friendly law firm, the law firm that was friendly to Down, jumped into bed with him, was Ness Motley itself. In terms of the State Farm factors, as I say, 3 of 5 are met, and I urge the court to, as I mentioned, consider the context in which this occurred and the extraordinary damage that this kind of behavior, its use of the court system to effectuate the damage and create the harm, really causes. And I think that that's a relevant factor for the court. We ask that the judgment be affirmed in its entirety, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. McCambridge. Mr. Cole, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. What you've heard, Your Honor, is essentially what pervades the brief of Interclaim, and that is what a terrible group of people Ness Motley are. Well, let us assume for the sake of argument they're the worst folks that ever came into this court, and by heavens, they're surely not. What Judge Posner said in Haslund and what has been said over and over and over again, it does not matter how reprehensible or terrible people are. In Bastian versus Petrin, for example, there was no question about how awful the defendants were. I think Judge Posner said, well, defrauders are a bad lot and they ought to be punished, but they weren't because loss causation prevented it. You have yet to hear from Interclaim in the briefs or in the argument that was just made to you what the harm was. I would like, Judge Cudahy, to respond to something that you brought up and I think is significant. You characterize as contingent all of these things as though that somehow that appellation is significant and decisive of the case. I would refer the court to page 20 of our opening brief. Speculative claims are not ripe for adjudication under Article 3, citing Supreme Court cases. The most important ripeness consideration is the extent to which, and I am now quoting, the claim involves uncertain and contingent events that may not occur as anticipated or indeed may not occur at all, citing the First Circuit in 1990. In that event, quote, the threat of injury is not real and immediate, and there is no case or controversy, citing the Supreme Court. So to say these events are contingent is simply to recognize the obvious, but it's precisely because of the contingency and the lack of occurrence of those things that there can be.
And the things are valued every day of the week that have contingency.
Your Honor, one doesn't ever get to the question of valuing anything until you prove there's harm. Harm is the antecedent to valuation. There is no such thing as valuation in the air any more than there is negligence in the air.
Your opponent says you put them in the bankruptcy. So
the opponent says lots of things, and it simply isn't true. We did not learn, for example, about the financial vulnerability until a month after the TRO was lifted. If one goes back and looks, you will see in the retention agreement and you will see in the ICEA, which was part of the retention agreement, Ness Motley represented it had the financial wherewithal to complete this project to its ultimate termination. No one knew anything about Interclaim's difficulties until a month after the TRO was lifted, and that was the event that was said to cause harm. There was no targeting of a financially vulnerable victim because we didn't know they were financially vulnerable. As to the statement to you that all of these 418,000 potential folks were sick and poor and elderly, it's simply false. There isn't a particle of evidence in this record to support it. There was never a showing even that the bulk of the people involved were residents of Illinois so that the Consumer Fraud Act case could be applied. The argument that somehow this is
you bring up Illinois, just tell me, why in this worldwide fraud and these 500,000 or so victims is Madison County
I can't answer that. I know that it's...
Elected by...
There have been all sorts of articles that have written about Madison County. I'm not a class action lawyer, but I suspect it must be a hospitable forum.
I would assume so. You're not a class action lawyer, but you're the lawyer when the class action lawyer...
Well, I understand, but there's nothing illegal about being involved in Madison County or selecting a favorable forum. I mean, I don't know Judge Evans, to say what there is beyond that. That case, by the way, is still pending. So to say that the class got nothing is false. The case is still pending. There at least is a tentative settlement in principle, and that's where the case is. The argument that it is a diversion to refer to the International Claims Enforcement Agreement is nonsensical. In order to determine whether the interclaim got more through this lawsuit than it would have gotten had there been no breach, one must look to see what would have occurred in Canada. And that's what its experts said you had to look at. It said the ICEA would have been replaced by one of equal or identical terms. And to say that the argument has been waived, which is what Judge Pallmeyer has said, because it wasn't referred to, some of these specifics were not referred to, is utterly wrong as a matter of law. And I refer the court to Casper versus St. Mary of Nazareth Hospital, which is cited in our reply brief, where Judge Posner says, since Casper's lawyers did not mention present value to the jury, it is doubtful to say the jury followed the method of computation we, the court, has selected. But so what? We look at it as a bottom-line approach. You look at the evidence. We could have waived closing argument, and it wouldn't have mattered. The question is the evidence there to support one proposition or another? What the district court did in terms of repeated activity is to ignore exactly what State Farm said. What she did is she atomized, she broke up into its constituent elements and factual incidents the breach. What State Farm has said, and then I will finish. What State Farm said is there must be a replication of prior transgressions. The defendant must be a recidivist. One is not a recidivist because one completes a particular breach of contract or a particular breach of fiduciary duty. So in that sense, she was wrong. And I thank the court very much.
We thank counsel for both the appellant and the appellee, and the case will be taken under advisement.